Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 139 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. And this week, I'm joined by Dave Johns. And man, it's another one, the first time we've met. And it was amazing. I was approached to ask if I'd be interested in having Dave on. I think the publishers and whatever were unaware that I've raved about this film tons already on the podcast. Daniel Blake was one of my films of the year. All the performance in it, absolutely amazing, absolutely astounding. So I jumped at the chance to have Dave on, aware that he's been a touring stand-up for 20, 30 years. So I was confident he'd be capable of holding his own on a podcast, and he more than delivered. Before we get into it, as ever, Speech Development Records. I speak a bit to David about the Edinburgh Fringe. And if you go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, you can get my Edinburgh Fringe show on DVD or as digital download. The digital download is only a fiver, I think. So you can watch that and hopefully enjoy it. It's good fun. I recommend it. There's other good stuff there, but have a look round. I've got some amazing merch coming out soon, if I can afford it. I've just got quotes through, and I'm trying to look at if I can afford to do this outlandish merch ideas, but I think I can. So that will come soon, but I won't tell you about that just yet. As something I will tell you about is the upcoming podcast from Chris and Stu, famed of the Drunk Cast. They've got a new podcast starting on the Distraction Pieces Network. I think already you can go and download the preview episode. So I do that. It's called Hardcore Listing, and it's a list show, and they've got amazing guests lined up. They've already recorded an episode with me. The subject I chose to give my top five of was my top five US TV dramas. I think on lists it's key to go specific. It's hard to do kind of here's my top five TV shows, because how can you compare Alan Partridge to The Wire? You know, you get completely different things from them. So yeah, I do that, and that was a lot of fun. They've got some amazing guests. Genuinely awesome. I'm excited to listen. It's similar to the Tuesday Night Jaw episodes I'm not on, that I'm kind of excited to not be on them because I get to listen to them as a fan. And this is exactly it. Oh, we had such a good conversation here. I'm excited for what's to come. And I've heard their kind of preview intro episode, and they're as ridiculous and useless as you will remember them from the Drunk Cast. So it's going to be entertaining, I promise you that. So that is all to come. But go now to iTunes or Acast or wherever you choose to go and look up Hardcore Listing, and you should, I'm recording this a few weeks in advance, they should have the intro episode up by now. If not, it'll be up soon. And you can download that, and what's handy is if you subscribe to it now, because it means that when they launch, they'll get that big influx of day one downloads, which will help them get more coverage and climb up the charts and hopefully get some love on iTunes and Acast. So yeah, check that out. Let's get on with the podcast, man. This is a rambling intro. This is with Dave Johns, and he's got an amazing story. It's beautiful. It's beautiful how his career has gone. I mentioned it in the podcast, I think, but it's so rare. I've got a lot of mates who are comedians, and comedy, as any entertainment industry, can be a bitter, angry little industry. And it's so rare that someone has a big break and huge success, and everyone seems to just be so happy and proud of them and excited for them. There's normally, even if there's on the surface happiness and pride and support, you'll talk to them in private and they'll be like, man, I would have been better in that role, or I could have done that. Not the case with Dave. Everyone's so hype about all the awards and plaudits he's receiving for I, Daniel Blake. An amazing film that I think everyone should see. But we talk about that plenty, so let's get on with the podcast. This is episode 139 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Dave Johns. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Yes, I'm joined today by Dave Johns. Because officially
my mum used to call us David when I did anything wrong.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Dave. Yeah,
so
Dave.
You're doing a lot right at the moment.
Well,
so yeah, we'll stick
right
with Dave.
Yeah,
so,
with yeah. Dave, yeah.
So how's it all going? Well, it's a bit of a mental time at the moment, yeah, with BAFTAs and all sorts.
Yeah, it has since we started the we shot the film in 2015 in October in Newcastle.
Yeah.
And all I was thinking was, just don't fuck it up, Dave. Just
yeah,
don't fuck
yeah,
it up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just don't be the one that ruins Ken Loach's career.
Yeah.
And so I was, and then when it went to Cannes and won the BAFTA, the Palme d'Or.
Yeah.
And it's just snowballed from then.
It's been crazy. And it's beautiful. It's one of the beautiful things of independent as cinema is that you don't have that kind of all the focus is on that first week of cinematic release.
Yeah,
it seems like there's been a constant rumble and constant excitement about it.
Yeah. Well, it started from Cannes, basically. I mean, we got a message on the Thursday when they showed the first few press screenings that the critics were crying. In being a typical comic, I was going, oh shit, was it that bad? And they went, no, they're really moved by it. And then since then, it just went and, like, you know, I've been going around different film festivals, you know, I've been doing film festivals,
yeah.
You know, Sarajevo, which is I don't know if you've been to Sarajevo.
No, I never have.
What a cool city that's got, yeah. A great vibe to it, you know,
yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool. They had, and we went to San Sebastian and Locarno, and it's been just, it's like, you know, like a snowball just takes off,
yeah.
Down the thing. It's just gathered, in all these red carpets. And basically, I'm just going, well, let's have fun with it.
Let's make the most of this, right? It's beautiful. I went to a preview of it because it's weird that this has come about because it was on the cinematic release. It was a sponsor of the podcast. And
right.
When I have a sponsor, I go to a preview. And I tweeted about it at the time saying how much I loved it. And the beautiful thing I found was the outpouring of all the different stand-ups I know proudly saying, I know him.
Oh, I know.
I know Dave. The support has been amazing.
Well,
right?
Yeah. I mean, when I was doing it on Facebook, from when I got the audition, I was just making story, you know, just trying to tell people what was going on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I said, should I keep on going? They'll go, no, do it. And it was like, they said they were all feeling as though that, like, they were there in Cannes,
yeah.
On the red carpet.
Yeah.
And they've been following it all the way through. And it's been really support. I mean, I've been surprised at how fantastic to, you know, a man and a woman, they've all been so enthusiastic about it, you know?
And it's an industry that can go the opposite way.
Yeah,
you,
well,
know?
You know,
again,
yeah.
I've got good,
yeah.
Mates in the comedy industry,
yeah.
Openly admit that even if a close friend of theirs gets a gig that they wanted,
yeah.
There's a little part of them going, I hope it's shit.
Well,
I
used to always say the collective noun for a group of comics is a bitter.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're hanging around together. But no, they've been absolutely fantastic. So supportive, you know, they all took photographs when the posters went up in the tube, you know,
yeah.
They all took photographs with them stand. It became a thing, like one person did it with the hand up
in
the air.
Of course.
So they all started doing it. So I had,
yeah.
Like loads of like tweets of me with the, you know, them all with the hand up. And yeah, and it's been fantastic for the film, you know. It's just been it's kept it in the news, it's kept it alive, and you know, I'm so chuffed with it, you know.
Yeah.
It's great, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk mainly,
yeah.
About the film, but I also want to kind of rewind a bit to before that opportunity came up and talk about your stand-up career and being a touring comedian. But let's even go back,
yeah.
a further. When you were growing up, was... Yeah. Or was comedy and stand-up, or even acting now, always something on your radar, or...?
Well, I used to watch in the sort of like in the late 50s, early 60s, I remember watching like Hancock's Half Hour with my dad,
yeah.
You know? And you know, so I was aware of, like, I love little, some of my favourite shows were things like, you know, Hancock's Half Hour, and I used to love Up Pompeii with Frankie,
yeah.
Howard and all,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
you know what,
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I watched all the, like, you know, the classic sitcoms, and Dave Allen, I used to love Dave Allen, you,
yeah.
Know? And it was those storytellers, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but it wasn't, you know, it was always, I think, you know, you have these standard things where you go, oh, were you always funny in school? And I suppose I was. I wasn't great at academic, but I was probably funny in school. But you know, yeah, I always loved humour because I think humour can get you out of a lot of,
yeah.
Scrapes. It did when I was, like, when Tougher Lads used to try and, you know,
yeah.
Humour seems to, I was able to get out of stuff by making jokes.
Jokes,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting one. A friend of mine, Stephen Camden, who's a writer and spoken word artist
from Birmingham, he always kind of said, look, I don't see it as poetry or anything. He's like, this is just what my nan used to do around the dinner table. It's storytelling. Yeah. And particularly having spent a fair bit of time in the Northeast, again, there's just this humour and crack and laughs, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, if you make them laugh, the bullies don't punch you.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
exactly. They don't see you as a threat. You know what I mean? You know? So that was something I did, yeah.
So when did you kind of turn that into a career or decide to?
Well,
it's very much, again, the Northeast, it's very much a good, solid working class area. You'd often feel aspirations of show business or entertainment to be an unusual one or outside of what would be normally expected, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, there was only in the Northeast that then, if you wanted to do comedy, it was only workmen's clubs, you know, and I never really was drawn to that. What happened was I used to work sort of in a theatre in the fly floor. I packed in doing Brickley and I worked at the Titan Theatre in the fly floor. And that's why a lot of the comics call me Davy Showtunes, because I know loads of musicals, because I used to lean over the, like the railings when I'd changed scenes and just listened to all these musicals.
Amazing.
And I came down to London to the Comedy Store, and that was just when the sort of, in the sort of 86, 87, when it was all sort of like, you know, when the Comedy Store started and the comedy, and, you know, and Rick Mayall and all them and Tony Allen, and it was all like, you know, the alternative scene was starting.
Yeah, the alternative scene was blowing up and becoming a real thing.
And I went to the Comedy Store and I was blown away by the gig, four comics on, and I just thought, wow. And I thought, it was suddenly this thing just went, that's what you could do. Yeah. So I thought, wow. So I came back and there was a theatre. In the theatre, they had a restaurant called the Comedy Cafe, which was it wasn't doing anything, you know, it was empty all the time. So I said, can I put some comedy on? They went, we're not giving you any money. I went, oh, no, I'll just put it on myself. I'll pay for it. So I got in touch with them. Somehow I got a hold of Jack D and Joe Brand when they were just starting off.
Yeah,
I said, will you come to Newcastle and do a gig at my club? And I hadn't even started the club. And they went, but we'd won £100 cash. And I went, and this was sort of 1989. And I went, what, each? They went, yes. I said, £200. I said, yeah, all right. And so I booked them. And then I got the room and I got it on a Friday night and I did loads of photocopied sort of like leaflets, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was a big, you know, in basically where my audience first came from was Newcastle University.
Yeah.
And the Poly that was there then.
Yeah.
And I just went round there and Joe was just starting to, you know, make a little bit of a wave, you know?
Yeah.
So I had to go, right, I've got to get £200 from somewhere. So I thought, I don't even know how much to charge. So I charged, I thought, what if I get a, so I charged 200, sorry, I charged 375 to get in. And because I couldn't get a late license, I had to have like a soup and a bun. So I had to serve food, you know?
Serve food as part
so,
of it,
so,
right?
And even Jack D always says, now I always remember playing your club and everybody was eating soup with a bun and he was going, why is it eating? And it was like some sort of weird Geordie thing, you know? And Joe and Jack came up and says, who's going to comp? And I went, oh, me. And I just got in it that way by having to go and do it.
Amazing, yeah.
And then within 6-7 weeks, the club had queues around the block.
That's amazing.
You know, and we did a Friday and Saturday night and everybody played there. Steve Coogan, Eddie Izzard, Frank Skinner, you know, everybody who are massive now, you know. Yeah. I gave Ross Noble his first gigs when he was 14.
Fantastic. When he was 14, goddamn.
His dad used to drive him down to the club. And he was too young. He used to have to stay in the kitchen. He used to come out, do his 5 minutes, and then run off again. You know,
I love that.
Yeah, you know. So Ross has got a big affection for. And it's so funny. That you know, Ross always talks about his first time on stage, and it was at the Comedy Cafe in Newcastle, in sort of like in the early 90s. You know,
yeah.
And that's how I got into it. And then I came down and did open spots and got into the store, because I'd been doing stand up for like maybe 2 years before I came to London. So when I did an open spot, I was getting booked because I was, you know, up to speed, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, we had a great time there, you know? We had so many. Harry Hill did his first gigs there. Sean Locke, Bill Bailey when he's in the Rubber Bishops. We had all the weird acts like Steve Murray, who used to torture teddy bears on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was this really weird act called Lady Belinda, and she had this basket with a puppet goose in it.
Right.
And she had a big hat on with these little bits of string hanging down with loads of fruit on. And she had, and then she'd put her hand through the basket and she'd go, "Hello, this is my friend Oswald." And then she'd turn the hand puppet to her and go, how are you today, Oswald?" And then before Oswald answered, she'd pull the string and a curtain would come across her hat so you couldn't see her face. And then she'd go, "I'm very good. How are you, Lady Bracknell?" And then she'd pull it and the curtain would come back. Brilliant. You know, mad, crazy acts like that. And Chris Lynham, who's a sort of like a great sort of like you know, used to finish with a firework up his arse, a Roman candle.
Amazing.
Playing, and there's no business like show business. And these acts aren't around anymore, you know, because acts have got too slick now, you know, but all those mad, you know.
And I mean, again, particularly at that point, it's weird because it's hard to imagine now with how interlinked even just the UK is with the internet and with travel and with everything else. But at that point, there may have been a burgeoning an easily accessible alternative comedy scene in London.
Yeah.
But when you bring something like that to the North East, no one will have seen anything like that before.
No.
Comedy was, as you said, a big bloke holding a pint.
Yeah.
And when telling his jokes.
Yeah, and then when his jokes didn't work, he sang "Fly Me to the Moon" and he got them back, and then he would tell his jokes again.
Yeah.
And so my club was one of the first clubs outside London that was doing, like, if you would like, what they'll call alternative comedy. Yeah. And, you know, and the students went crazy for it, you know, they did, you know, and then they would come and report it, and then it got to a wider audience, you know. But that was, like, in the early 90s, that was when it was booming, you know.
Yeah.
You
know? How much did you have to kind of force yourself to head down to London and focus on your career rather than, because again, if you've got a club that's working and you've got your comfort, it's local, it's your home ground, it's easy to kind of go, let's just stay here.
To push yourself to
go down to London and tour and whatnot.
I think what it was that other acts were going, you should come down to London, and I came down, you know, and in like the big thing at the time was the Comedy Store was the mecca, and you were thinking, God, if I could get a booking in here, then I've arrived, you know. And I remember getting my first weekend booking at the Comedy Store, I was like ecstatic, you know. But that was all, and that's how I, like, you know, like Mark Lamar and all those guys, and you know, even now, big established comics always go, "I used to love your comedy club," you know, because it had that packed in, 200 people packed in, tables around the small stage, the atmosphere, you know, because you need that, you know, we need it doesn't always work in every room, you know, and in that atmosphere. And when people are packed in and it's dark and just a light on a stage, it's infectious laughter, you know. But we used to have all sorts of different acts, you know. Now people start to book on the internet. It's like, you know, they just put out an email, "I want comics," and then loads of comics email them. Yeah. And then it's like standing at the bloody factory gates where I'm going, where my day, I would curate the bill. I would go, "I want something weird. I want a one-liner. I want somebody with a guitar. Yeah. I want a normal stand-up." Now the bills don't seem to have that curated feeling, you know?
It's because, and again, not to jump in and think I can analyse it in one swoop, but it's because at that point, from the story you've just told, you started it because you were excited about having some comedy. You didn't know about the business side of it or anything else. It was just a comedy side. Whereas now, comedy, you know, it's a good thing and a bad thing, but comedy is seen as a way of making money, of being famous, because you've got that. It's kind of, I want to be a successful comedian rather than I want to be a good comedian, or here's the comedy I want to do. So I guess that's the difference. There will be business-minded people that, like, right, a Friday night comedy, it'll be less messy than a club night.
Yeah.
There'll be less risk and less fights and less trouble.
Yeah.
Let's put a comedy night on, rather than, as you said, who's going to work as the headliner and who's going to work before them and who's not going to clash styles, because you want the headliner to get the reaction he should.
Any comic on the circuit will tell you the best clubs are run by people who love comedy, who are doing it because they love comedy. You know, there's places like, there's Andy White, who's a great promoter, who does it around sort of Cambridge way.
Yeah.
His clubs are great because he loves, you know, Rob Riley over Manchester, Northwest way. All his clubs are great because he does it, obviously, to make money, but his first and foremost is he loves comedy.
Yeah.
And they are the best, you know, that's the best to come from passion, you know what I mean?
It's a beautiful thing. I was talking to a friend of mine, Jim Smallman, the other day. And he's got some other stuff going on with his wrestling company that's all going very well. And he's getting to the point where he doesn't have to do comedy and just talking to me, was so happy at the idea of getting to just do the gigs he wants to do. That's play the comedians and these ones that he loves.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's a beautiful situation. He's like, even if I don't have to, I'm never going to stop doing comedy because I love it. Mm. But the thought of only having to do those clubs that you've mentioned that are the ones that are great.
But that's the dream, right? Well, it is, because what happens is, like you know, you had the big chains, Jonglers. Now, I started doing Jonglers when I only had one sort of club in Battersea, and it was great, you know, and then Camden, and then it got big, you know, and you were doing good money at those clubs. Yeah. But what seemed to happen was that like at first they were playing great, but then what happens was for some reason it changed when they started selling second ticketing to like Stag and Hen dudes.
Yeah, yeah.
And once that goes down that road, and it's all right for the people who are running the bar side, go, yeah, oh well, we're just getting loads of people in and Stag and Hens, but it became a really tough gig to do.
Yeah.
And what happens is you go, well, I'm just doing this just for the money.
Yeah.
And if you're doing it just for
that's
the money,
not nice, right?
Yeah. Well, then you might as well be doing any job for the money, you know? I mean, you can do it. It's great. You have to pay your bills, but you also have to some sort of like, you know, there has to be some sort of, for me, an artistic side to it as well. Yeah. And, you know, why you want to do it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of comics now, I think, regret that they went, and I did, I spent too much time playing to Stags and Hens, and it was making me unhappy.
Yeah, yeah.
And my missus said, why are you doing these gigs when they make you so happy? I'd rather you sat in the house where we didn't have any money, we just had a glass of wine, than you coming back and saying, oh, I can't do this anymore. And so I made a conscious decision to actually go, no, I'm not doing them anymore.
You know? That's great. Because, you know? Again, and people don't think about the fact that if you turn your passion into your job, it's heartbreaking when it becomes that point where it's not enjoyable and it's not fun. It's different if you're working in an office, that's never been like, oh, I'm passionate about working in an office. It's always been a means to an end. But when you've started doing comedy, because you fucking love comedy, you adore it.
Yeah.
And then you're going out each night thinking, I just want to get this over with and get in the car and drive home. So that's not only a job you don't enjoy, it's killing a passion of yours as well.
Well, it's sad because when the Jonglers chain first started, there were nice gigs and people, and I thought, oh, this is good, you're earning decent money. But very, very often it happens where people go, see this, oh, God, this, all right, well, if we could sell all the tickets, like, and not have to market, just sell it to this company who sells a whole package where they've got paintballing during the day and then they go to a nightclub and they go to comedy. And so they're going there and they're not even interested in the comedy. And that time is when it all goes like shit, you know what I mean? And you know, you've got to keep that passion, you know, you've got to keep that passion because that is what makes you creative.
Yeah, yeah.
If you lose your creativity, then what are you doing? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I've just, because now what's happening with me, I made a conscious decision and I'm so much more happy doing the gigs I want to do.
Yeah.
And the tour I'm starting, and I'm going back up to Edinburgh, you know, I'm doing the
Edinburgh
Festival.
I haven't
been to the Edinburgh Festival to do stand-up since 1999, 17 years going back, you know?
And that must be exciting, right?
And it's because I've suddenly found a new a new voice, if you like, and a new passion for it, and a new, like you know, a young comic once said to me, and it's like, and I always remember it, and it really, really stuck with me. He said, "You know what I love about you, Dave?" He goes, "You've been doing this for nearly 3 decades, and your eyes aren't dead."
Yeah,
and he goes, "That makes me think that I can keep doing this."
Yeah.
And I went, "You know, that's the nicest." You know, he said, "You see, a lot of comics have been doing it for a long time, and it's like you say, it's just doing it, and that's." But for me, I always try to keep the passion, you know what I mean? You know,
and
you
that
know?
Feels like it must be from picking the right gigs. Because I've seen comedians who, and Edinburgh's a great example. I adore Edinburgh. I think it's such an amazing coming together of so many creative arts and beautiful things. But I also know a lot of comedians who, it's almost a prison sentence every year.
Oh,
for
yeah.
Because they're like,
the pressure.
I've got to go and do my show. And it's huge pressure of going every year because you have to, because you're a comedian.
Yeah.
And that's your job. You have to go and do it. And the mates I have who go, or the relief in the voice of someone who goes, I'm not doing it this year. It's kind of, there's such a happiness and calmness.
I don't have to go to the biggest art festival in the world. Yeah. Thank God for that. I know.
But it's weird, isn't it?
It is.
It's a weird one. It must be what keeps it alive in someone like you, that you've gone, right, I've not been for 17 years because I've not had anything I want to do there.
Yeah.
If I want to go and do something, well, I will, and you're returning now. But you haven't had that.
Yeah. So. And a lot of young comics get pressurised by management and by going, you've got to go up every year, you've got to go up every year. Yeah. Sometimes it works for people to go up every year and build an audience. Sometimes, like you say, me and Sean Lott used to liken it too, when you used to go up and you used to go out and meet people. It's like, you know, there's old war films where the dam... and they go, oh no, the dam's fine. And one of the guys goes out to check the dam and he goes, oh no, it's all right. And then he walks away and all of a sudden a little bit of concrete falls off.
Yeah.
And a little crack goes, and a little trickle of water comes out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could see comics as the festival went on be like that dam.
Yeah.
It was like the first bit was like all solid.
Yeah,
and then you'd see like, and then the next day you see like a little crack would come and a little bit of water would run down.
Yeah.
And then by about 2.5 weeks, we were just, the pressure.
Yeah.
But some take to it really well in Edinburgh. Yeah. Some thrive on it, and some, I think, it damages them. So for me, I always found Edinburgh a bit sort of like that, a bit sort of like I've done plays up there in the last 17 years, but the stand-up always seemed a bit like too much pressure. Like I say, I didn't have anything to say.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's no point in me going up with a set from the clubs and just going, I'm just going to, But now with the film and with everything that's happened to me and the change in how I feel, I've got something to say, so I want to say it,
completely.
So
having been... As said, a working job in stand-up for three decades, how was it when you got the call about auditioning, at least, for a Ken Loach film? Like, what was the process? Was it a call of, we want you, or was it a call of, look, you're in line?
Yeah, no, what happened was I did a play up in Edinburgh with loads of comics called 12 Angry Men, which was a massive big hit in the play, in the assembly rooms in 2003, and then we did one for the Cuckoo's Nest. We did The Odd Couple, Bill Belly, Alan Davis was in that. I played Murray the Cop, and so we did that, and those were really successful, and the producer, Guy Masterson, who produced that, just texted me one day, and this is the truth, and a couple of comics know this, but I was nearly ready to pack it in.
Yeah.
Just because the gigs were getting less. Somebody offered me cruise ships. I would rather go and work in a factory than work in a cruise ship. That to me is comedy hell to me.
Right, yeah, yeah.
To have somebody who's the cruise director telling you what you can see and what you can't see. These passengers going out, that would kill me. I mean, some people love doing cruise ships. I said, if I've got to do that, that's me done.
Yeah.
And it was sort of...
I've always heard that one of the keys of comedy is not having to join the crowd once you're finished. And on a cruise ship,
can you
that's
imagine
it.
Just
you're there,
walking
you're there
around
for the whole
and you
month.
Die on your arse and people are just going, there he is, you know what I mean? And you're just sitting there, it's a nightmare.
That's why you have backstage and stage entrance and stage exit.
And then you go down to the crew bar and there's the MD from the band just getting himself pissed every night,
because
he's going, I wanted to be a rock star, you know what I mean?
So
I thought that, and I applied, and this is, I thought, I've got to, I don't want to go to Hull for 130 quid.
Yeah.
It's just not on, And it wasn't because anything had happened in my stand-up. I mean, still had the passion for stand-up. It was just that there were so many comics, loads of part-time comics who have jobs who don't care if they don't get paid. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not good comics, but if you've got a salary coming in, then you go, I'll go for 100 quid because I used to do it for nothing.
Yeah.
But if you're a full-time comic, it's hard.
Yeah.
So I applied for a donkey license on Whitley Bay Beach.
Amazing.
I took my daughter to Scarborough and I talked to the donkey guy and I just started talking to him and he goes, I've been doing this for years. My dad did it before me.
Yeah.
He says, I just work in the summer and then I stable the donkeys with people who've got horses because they make good stable companions.
Yeah.
So you don't have to look at, you just pay the bet,
Yeah.
And then I go away to Spain. So I make all my money in the summer and I thought, wow, just walking along. So I thought, there's three beaches in Newcastle. There's Whitley Bay, Tynemouth and Culler Coast. I thought, I'd have three teams of donkeys. I could just listen to some music in the summer.
Yeah.
£2 a ride. And I was thinking, you could do that and you could make it. I thought, so I applied and I looked into how you look after donkeys and where you got donkeys from. And my daughter was all excited, you know?
And
I told Sean Locke and he just pissed himself laughing. He goes, I knew you'd do something mad like that. Dave's donkeys. He goes, it'd be hilarious,
It didn't make sense though.
And I said, I'll call all the donkeys by famous comedians' names, Whitley Bay and North Tyneside Council have a policy of not having any animals in circuses, or not having any animals who are, so they class that as you know,
yep,
performing, if
performance,
you like.
Performance, yeah.
And the reason why it's been all right in Scarborough is because it's since the 30s they've had donkeys.
Yeah, they've always had them.
So it's never ended.
Right.
Now, donkeys in Whitley Bay hadn't come around since, like, the last ones were in the early 70s.
Yeah.
So they've just got a policy of not having it, you know?
Right.
And so I went, me donkey dream's gone. And then I got this text. Would you like, Ken Loach is looking for a guy your age, northeast. So I went, oh, so, and Kayleen Crawford, who's the casting director, I saw her at one of the big do's for the awards, and she said to me, I've still got your text. She said, it makes us laugh now. What's happened to the film? It went, yeah. Hello, my name's Dave Johns. I'm a comic. And yeah, Ken Loach is looking for a bloke my age. I'd be up for that. And she said, I've got to see this bloke. So she just got set up a meeting and I came in, seen Ken, had 10 minutes to talk to him, cracked on, talked about football. He's a big football fan.
Yeah.
He just wanted to know where I was from, didn't want to know what I'd done before.
That's great.
And he said, well, we'll come and have you in. I came in, I did three castings where I was with different actresses,
yeah,
where we just did conversations with each other, you know. And the first actress I did, and the first in Spotlight in London was Hayley, who plays Kate.
Amazingly as well.
She's on her way now, that girl, yeah, you know. She's 26 and she's amazing talent. And something must have gelled with me and her.
Yeah.
And then I went away and I did it with other girls, came back for a final casting. Two girls I hadn't met, and Katie,
yeah,
and Hayley, in Newcastle, half a day. And then he phoned me up and he goes, will you be in my film? I was like, what? Wow.
Yeah.
And the first thing I remember is just, Dave, just don't fuck this up.
Yeah.
Just don't fuck this up.
It's amazing, though. I think the location of it is absolutely key and a masterstroke, because as often with Ken, or more so than ever, I'd say, or as much as ever, it's a heavy story and a heavy subject. Mm. There's a lot of bleakness, but there's always been a humour and a let's just get on with it attitude in the Northeast that kind of makes it a film that you can go in and enjoy. It's not just this, oh, this is going to be heavy, this is going to be hard work. It's really enjoyable. It's light. And your character, Daniel Blake, has exactly that, of kind of some really heavy stuff happens to him.
Mm-hmm.
And at no point is he really kind of, there's no dramatic breakdown scene.
No.
It's always very much a, well, this is how it is.
I've got to get on with it.
Let's continue
I think
on.
That's what it is. And that's from Paul Lafferty's writing, you know. Yeah. Paul is very good at, I always believe that, you know, a good writer, I mean, you should never sit and watch a film and think, oh, somebody wrote that.
Yeah.
A good writer should disappear. And you only are aware of him when you see the credits at the end. And that's what with Paul, his words and his, and are believable. They feel as though they're coming out of a character, out of the character's mouth, you know.
Yeah.
And they seem real and, you know, it's like, you know, we all use humour in every, that's what gets you through tragedy sometimes, is humour, you know?
100%, yeah.
And so, yeah, and it was such an amazing thing. In the way Ken works as well, you know, he just gives you a couple of pages of script each day. He lets you live the part. You don't know I didn't know what was going to happen in the food bank scene.
Oh, brilliant.
It was only Ken and Hayley and Robbie Ryan.
Oh, wow.
The director of photography, who knew what was going to happen.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so it was, and even all the people who were in this food bank, nobody knew. So it was, I knew that I had to go to to Katie and say, look, you've done nothing wrong, don't be upset, you know, you've done really well with kids.
Yeah.
But I thought it was because she broke down because she was getting a food handout.
Yeah.
I didn't know because I didn't know she was going to just get the hand.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and what happened, I don't want to put a spoiler in it, but you know, that thing that happens. And so that's a very, very moving scene, you know. And Mark Commode, who's the who's the film critic, I mean, he says it's one of the most powerful scenes he's seen in cinema for a long time, you know.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And it's beautiful to hear that it's worked in such a way that it is kind of a, you've got your script, but there's a level of, again, it allows that, it allows the script to disappear because it's not on paper telling you, and you're going to react like this, and you're going to react like this. It's like, here's what we need you to say because the dialogue's important, but
we want you to react.
We want you to react naturally to this and have it as a rule. So kind of, I love that kind of just letting, because again, in reality, you don't know what someone else is thinking in real life in any situation. No. As stupidly obvious a statement as that is. Whereas if you've got a script and you've read exactly how that character's feeling and exactly how how you're feeling and that character over there, then that's going to change your perception of it all, because you're going to be overly aware.
It's not going to be from the gut. But Ken always writes this. There's a lovely story in Finding Eric, you know, his film about Eric Cantona, where the guy who got the role, he said to him, so he never told him that Eric Cantona was actually going to be in the film.
Amazing.
So he thought, oh, it's about this guy who's having marriage problems and he's a massive big Man United fan and he's trying to find Eric Cantona to help him because he thinks Eric Cantona will help him. But the actor always said to me, he always thought, but I don't think it'll be either a looking likey or I'll never find him.
Yeah.
And he said this day in the set, he came on, he goes, right, you got to open it. And he said, the doorbell's going to ring, open the door and somebody's going to deliver something for you. And he went, all right. And he opened the door and Eric Cantona was standing there. And he went, fucking hell, it's you. And that's what's in the film. That first thing of him going, hell, it's you.
Because it really was.
Yeah, it really was him, And Ken says, you can't fake that, you know. So that's the excitement of working with Ken Loach. And he's such a lovely man. And I used to love his soft, like he's steely in what he wants. He knows what he wants. He's not a fool. He knows what he wants, but he so gently knew all the extras' names on set.
Yeah.
And he would always lovely this thing. And I even remember it now when he used to go, okay, turning over, when you're ready, Dave. You know, that lovely, like that lovely gentleness, and you feel safe, and it's like being with a family. So it was amazing, amazing experience. You know?
It's lovely. And there has to be huge, it's great that in an ever, again, as similar to common comedy, in an industry that's becoming all the more driven and pressured by financial gain and money in the film industry, there's so much money in that industry. It's great that there are still people like Ken that people are comfortable to put their faith in, to not have the complete, you know, the beginning, middle and end of this script. You're going in there going, it's Ken Loach.
And he's got
I trust it.
Yeah, and he's got a passion for giving people who haven't got a voice. Yeah. I mean, you know, in just to sum up what the guy's like, when we were in Cannes, he was standing and Mark Rylance was talking to him.
Yeah.
And Mark Rylance said to him, oh, Ken, Daniel Day-Lewis came over to my house a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we watched all your films back to back.
Yeah.
And Ken said to him, did you not want to kill yourself? You know, he wasn't, you know, like, experience going, oh my God, thank you very much. You know, like, but that's how, you know, he knows what he wants, but he doesn't take himself that serious, you know.
And I love that.
Yeah, you know, it was hilarious, you know.
So there must have been a lot of faith in the script and in the writers, but equally, did you feel a pressure to tell this story? Because it's a hell of a story. It's an important story, particularly right now. So there's a lot on everyone's shoulders. And, you know, spoiler alert, it turned out really good and everyone loves it and it's up for awards and it's gone great. But when you're making it, you don't know this is going to come across. So, was that?
Well, you know, when you're a comic, you know immediate.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Of course.
You're working on your own, you're on stage, you know how the show's going.
You say it into a mic and by the time it's left your mouth.
And you know whether you're going to die on your ass or whether
instant
you're going to pull
feedback.
It back. Yeah. Making a film in 2015 and then in 2017 it being up for 5 BAFTAs.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a massive big area where you don't know what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but
it's great now.
Yeah.
It's great at this moment because you know that's how the story ends.
Yeah.
It's not
that
bit in between.
You can just off here in London, car come in and pop in and see the edit, and I would walk in and he'd be like editing a bit of it. You see a little tiny bit of it with no, and it'd be all, the sound would be raw.
Yeah.
And you'd see the scene and you'd be like looking in the back of your head and I'd be going, and I'd go to him, so how's it going? He'd go, oh, it's all right. And I would go, okay, I hope it's better than all right.
It's petrified, right?
Yeah, it is petrifying. But, you know, the story has resonated with people. And I think it's because it's the right time, the right place. And the two characters, for ages, the people who have needed welfare and people who have needed sort of like help have always been in the narrative. There have been from, you know, Labour and Conservative governments has been that if you want welfare, then basically it's like you're guilty before proven that you're malingering, you're scrounger.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, Benefit Street and all that sort of.
That press storyline of benefit cheats, of things like that has put us all in this fear of someone's out to to get something rather life. Than they just they need help. To get what they need. Yeah.
And what's happened is, you know, there's less than 1% of fraudulent claims made. Less than 1%. Yeah. People think it's about 10%, yeah. And you can check that. That's a fact, you know. And what's great about it is that you know that Dan and Kate are shown as just ordinary people. It could be your mum, like, you know, Kate could be your daughter, it could be your sister, Dan could be your dad. And that's what's being sort of like people have picked up on when they watch the film. Oh my God, that could be my dad.
Yeah.
Just, you know, that the system isn't working anymore for people, you know? Yeah. And a known guy came up to me in Whitley Bay. I was in the shop after it came out, about 2 weeks after it came out, and I was buying a paper, and this old guy's about 80-odd, and he came up to me, he goes, and he looked at me, he goes, are you that guy who's in that Daniel Blake? And I went, yeah, I am, mate. And he goes, well, the next time you tell Ken Loach, you tell him from me that this film is giving a voice back to the working class that haven't been listened to for 40 years in this country.
Yeah.
And he summed it up completely right, you know what I mean, you know?
And that's it, the tone of it and the approach is perfect. I had a two-part homelessness special of the podcast recently, mm-hmm. and I referenced Daniel Blake in it because there was things like someone at a food bank and that kind of, well, how do you, like, one of the questions that people have at points is, well, how do you know the people coming in are really homeless? And their answer was, we don't, and we don't care. They need the food. If they need it, then they can have it. It doesn't matter if they're hungry. Are you really homeless? But
well, it's just horrible thing about, you know, the needy and deserving poor. You know, it's basically what Ken always says is that, you know, the thing they're trying to push to people is that if you don't get on in this world and you're poor, it's your fault.
Yeah.
It's your fault. There's something lacking in you. And, you know, there's loads of reasons why people fall by the wayside. We could all do it, you know? Like you know, most people are 3 wage packets away from needing help themselves. You just got to lose your job, both of you, if you're a family. And, you know, and who would want to go and take their kids to a food bank for an easy life? I mean, the humility of if having to do that, you know, how humiliating it is, sorry. So, you know, but this is, so this film, I think, this film redresses that, you know, and says, no, this system isn't working for any of us. It's not working for your, if your dad needed it, if your brother needed it, if your uncle needed it, if your grandfather needed it, if your grandma or your mother needed it, it isn't working for ordinary people. Yeah. And people go, oh, well, do you not think you should show it to the Conservative government? And you go, no, they know. Yeah, I mean, they're the ones who implement it.
They
know what they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
That's what I felt was so striking and amazing about this film was we've all walked past someone in trouble in the past, someone who's homeless, and you thought, how do they get to that? And the beauty of this film is there's no big dramatic a reason, and that's what makes it so relatable, that it could be anyone. It could be your dad, your granddad, your uncle, your cousin, because there's no, it would have been easy for a script writer to take this big dramatic, this huge event happened
and it could have been
tore everything apart. That's not what happens. No, it's kind of just regular stuff, and then it's like,
it's an ordinary life that needs help and has fallen apart. You know, and when you get people like Camilla Long and Toby, whatever his name is, Toby, that guy who writes for Camilla Long, who writes for the, you know, she does all this, and she was saying, well, you know, it's just worst case scenario. I mean, it isn't really like that, you know, and I was thinking she's probably getting over the great Bollinger shortage of 87. Yeah. I mean, I could take her by the hand to food banks now and go, do you think this is a fantastic thing to stand in line for free food? Do you think these people want to do this?
Yeah.
And it's because some people live in a life that they don't even want to know what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
You know? And you know, if we don't help people who are in need and people who are struggling, even though we're doing well, I mean, what does it say for us as human beings? This is why, you know, like, you know, we should all be coming together, not breaking apart, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what's got people angry. That's what's got people angry.
Yeah.
You know, there's either two things that happen in the film, the shown in the film. People sit in silence when it's ended and just sit and just crying, or just stunned, or they get really, really angry, you know?
I did exactly that. The screening I went to, I was literally on my own in the cinema.
Mm.
And even in that situation, it ended, and I sat there for a good while afterwards, just kind of just taking it in and going, and feeling that impact.
Yeah, I know. And it's happened when, like I've seen it with 8,000 people in Locarno, at the film festival Locarno, on a 24-metre screen in this town square in the Piazza Grandi, 8,000 people. You could hear a pin drop when that was on. And when it finished, there was a moment of silence, and then there was just thunderous rounds of applause. Yeah. People were coming up to me, even in the Locarno and even in Spain, and saying, "This is happening in this country as well."
Yeah, it's one that I feel in general that everyone should watch, and we're doing this around the digital and general a release. So everyone who's listening now, there is a way to go and pay to watch this.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, Enders, and it just felt it should be mandatory for anyone that works in public relations in any way in the public, because it highlights, and again, not in a attacking way, but in a very a realistic way, the fact that when you're dealing with people who need benefits or whatever else, again, as we were saying with stand-up, it becomes a job. It becomes mechanical, and it's very easy, unintentionally, through no fault of your own, not that you're a bad person, but it's very easy to dehumanise those people that you're dealing with. And they're another form or another problem, another case.
Yeah.
And a film like this, I think, will help a lot of people in that situation to remember that these are humans with real lives. As I said, that's not me attacking anyone who works in those situations. It's I can see how it happens, but it needs redressing.
But I also think that the people who are working and implementing this system are victims as well.
Yeah.
Because they are having to sanction people and cut people's benefits for the slightest little thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people are really, really upset about that. This is the people who talk to Ken about it, you know?
Yeah.
And they told Ken and Paul that they are asked, they have quotas that they have to fill.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't done enough sanctions in a week, we get pulled in by our bosses and going, what are you doing? Are you giving people an easy ride?
Yeah.
And, you know, and that, so these people as well, like having to implement this, which is a cruel system, you know, it's something that isn't set up to help the person. It's to save money.
Yeah.
And that's all it is, because people who are in need are the easiest people to cut from, because they don't have a voice, and it's easy to demonise people who need help. So the rest of us go, well, why should we let people have an easy go? And it's not that a case at all. This film is showing that it's ordinary people that need help. You know?
Yeah,
the system isn't working for any of us.
As said, and it's so easy to unintentionally and subconsciously demonise. I think I mentioned this in a previous podcast, but my mum is in charge of a few of the libraries and has always worked in libraries in my local area. And she had a problem recently where one of her librarians came to say, look, we've had this homeless guy who's coming in every morning and washing in the toilets.
Yeah.
You know, we've had to ban him. And my mum was like, why have you had to ban him? And it was, well, he's taking his clothes off and kids could walk in and whatever. I was like, well, that's understandable. And her response was, just give him the key to the disabled toilet. You know, it's not this horrible problem.
Like,
it's not someone who's wanting to be in that situation.
No.
This guy isn't like, my dream is to go and cause all this trouble and wash in the toilets of a library. It's like, that's horrible. He's like, so again, she was like, just do that. And then it solves it.
He's all right.
He's getting clean. He can lock him. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He can lock himself in and do that and be on the way. But again, I don't think it's that the librarian in question was intentionally being nasty, but in their mind, because we've built this thing up of the danger of strangers and homeless people and all this, the demonisation of they're all on drugs or they're all this or they're all that, they've gone, well, we need to ban this problem. And it's like, well, no, it's a...
I know.
Let's help it out. It's a small thing.
Yeah, and I think that's the same with, you know, I mean, if you look at the people who are working at food banks, the way they sort of... And, you know, the way they volunteer. And it's an amazing thing, because in the film, you know, when Katie shoplifts, she pays for all the food and she only shoplifts the stuff that she needs.
Yeah.
It's all sanitary products.
Yeah,
it's all, deodorant and razors that are woman needs to make herself, you know, feel right, and
yeah,
you know, sanitary products, and so what's happening now since the film, when people see them, they're donating things like that to that's the amazing. Food banks, you know
yeah.
what I mean, you know,
yeah,
so people are moved by it, and you see, but I think that's what the governments want. They want, they don't want the problem. They yeah. want us to deal with the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, and that's sort of, but it is a state problem. It is, because yeah. we all pay into this system. I'm so passionate about the National Health Service, and it's been run down. It's been made to fail so that it'll turn public opinion against it.
100%. And we're seeing it all
yeah.
already. I was reading a load of comments just last night about people saying how the NHS... it's shit. It's not up to standard.
This is what they're doing.
It's been made to be in that state.
To fail.
It's still absolutely, it's essential.
They can't get rid of the National Health Service without the will of the public.
Yeah.
And how do they do that? Like they've done with every single thing they've privatised. They run it down so yeah. it doesn't work. And then they go, well, if we bring some private people, it'll run better. And people yeah. go, all right, well, I might pay like, you know, 60 quid a month to have that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so you've got these private health companies circling us like sharks.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Theresa May has gone over to America to do these deals and has sold yeah. the National Health Service to them. You know, yeah, I wouldn't yeah. be surprised with that at all, you know.
Literally, I think it was 5 years ago, again, I remember I've had issues in hospitals and yeah. so on and so forth, from yeah. us, but I think it was only 5 years ago that when surveys were done all over the world, we were in the top five of health services. Yeah. And it's that short a time that things have been run down and driven as far into the ground as they can
yeah.
that makes it that, let's privatise.
Well, the National Health Service, it's something like over 800,000 people they deal with a day.
Mm.
And nobody talks about the good things they do.
Yeah.
All the stuff that's pushed is all about, you know, mistakes, and waiting lists
yeah.
and people on trolleys. But what about all the people that have, I mean, I'm 16, I've never had to pay for a doctor in my life
yeah.
and I've had good treatment in hospitals.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, my what's happening is, you know, it's a brilliant service, but it needs more money
yeah.
and it has to be, you know, they always find money to bomb people. They never find
yeah,
money
yeah,
to help
fine
people.
With that, aren't they?
Yeah.
But I mean, that aside, what you said about people donating sanitary products
yeah,
and things
yeah.
like that. I love that, because that's also going, well, fuck them then.
Yeah.
If the government aren't going to help, then we'll deal with this ourselves.
Yeah, yeah,
we'll go, right, yeah. we will continue to put pressure on the government to make yeah. improvements to improve these areas.
Yeah.
But equally, if we can just go out there and act upon it,
yeah.
let's act upon it now.
There's a group called A Bag for Katie.
Yeah.
And what it is they go round and they say, this is a bag for Katie, and it's female toiletries, you
yeah.
know, like a razor and tampons
yeah.
and things that, you know, you don't think about when you're poor and you've got no money,
yeah.
and you've got to feed your kids, and then you go, well, you know, buy them a pack of razors when I've got to feed my kids, or like even deodorant to keep
yeah.
yourself. And you see, people don't think, I mean, it's about when you're in that position, it's all right that you can get so much money and you can, and by the time you've paid your rent and you've paid all this, right? It's when, like, for instance, the kids' shoes
yeah.
go.
Yeah.
And you can't afford to pay 70 quid for a pair of kids' shoes, you know? And it's those things. And it's like, you know, what happens is the 0 hours contracts where you don't even know if you've got to work the next day.
Yeah.
And private landlords who are charging exorbitant rent, and if you ask them to do any work, they don't bloody do it. And it's all those things that you know, there's a lot of people in society who are left. Ken said to me, this is a thing that really touched me. He said to me, when you and Haley are doing a scene together, Dave, all you have to do is listen to each other. And if you listen to each other, you will find the truth. And if you find the truth, it will look right on screen.
Yeah.
And this is what I think, is we pretend to listen to each other, but we don't. And if we all started just listening to each other, we'd find out why people were angry,
yeah.
and why people
yeah.
are like, you know, so angry and so frustrated.
Yeah.
But we pretend to listen. We just pretend to go,
no.
you know.
Everyone's there
yeah.
to win,
yeah.
to win,
yeah.
to win
find
their argument,
people, yeah.
to win that side,
yeah, yeah.
rather than to have a discussion and go, right, so
find out what people are angry. Why are people angry,
yeah.
you know? Like, if you had a mate and your mate, and you go, God, he's, you know, bit being a bit weird.
Yeah.
If it was a good mate, you'd sit down and go, what's going on with you?
What's up? Yeah, yeah.
Come on, tell us what's wrong with you. And they wouldn't. That's what we should be doing all the time, but we don't. And so that's why there's a lot of anger, I think, around the place, you know?
I agree.
You know?
Well,
you know?
We're getting close to the hour mark, so I'll start to wrap things up now. But, okay. So what are we looking at? 3-4 years ago, that you were inquiring about a donkey license on
3 years ago.
On
numerous cold northeast beaches.
Beautiful northeast beaches. There's been some lovely reworkings around there and redevelopments. Yeah, they're lovely, but cold. And as we recall this, I mean, this will be going out in a couple of weeks, but as we record this, you're a week or so away from attending the BAFTAs where you're nominated. You've already won many awards for this film. So how is that? How's that feeling? And again, the beautiful part, it being for something that means something as well. And not to discredit any other films or TV, but this film was always set up as more than simply an act of art and entertainment. Yeah. It's been a social statement as well. So to get that kind of turnaround for such a great project, it must mean the world, right?
Yeah,
it must feel
I mean, you know, it's incredible. You know, as any person, you know, who does work in, you know, whether you write a book or you do poetry or you do stand up or you make a film or you're on stage or anything like that, you know, you dance, you do anything or create, if you make art. Mm-hmm. I mean, to have something that you create that you feel so proud about, you know, that you can say, you know, that this might be around forever, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if I never made another film ever again, I mean, to be in a Ken Loach, a lead in a Ken Loach film that has such social impact and has won so many awards. I mean, you know, I could sit in my old people's home in my rocking chair and just,
not bad, is
and
it?
Just be happy with that. You know what I mean?
So what is the plan going forward then? Obviously, you've got a reinvigorated meaning and push behind your stand-up now and you're returning to the fringe, but even on an acting point of view, is that something you wish to pursue more? Because acting has always been part of your life again, but it feels like you've been a stand-up comedian who acts sometimes. Is there any desire to go, actually, I'm an actor. I'm a fucking actor.
I'd love to do more film, you know. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, I'm doing a little thing at the moment up in the Northeast off in a couple of weeks, which is a lead in a sort of like a small independent film.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I've even had my... I've had my availability checked for Godzilla 2.
Amazing.
So, you know, I mean, there's a natural progression from Ken Loach to Godzilla 2.
Doesn't it?
But yeah, I mean, like, I would love to do more film, and people are like, people have sent scripts, and me and my agent are looking at the scripts and we're trying to find the right thing. And there's there may be another great role out there for me, but if there's not, and you know, I'll do interesting projects like I've always done. If I get offered a part in a film that isn't a lead but it's an interesting part, then I'd love to do it, you know. I mean, it's about, I think once you stop creating and having that passion for creating, then you might as well just be doing any job, you know what I mean? I feel, and it's definitely changed my life. I mean, you know, Ken Loach has changed my life, because not only have I got more actively politically, he's radicalized me, if you like. But also my stand-up has got another lease of life. I'm doing a tour which starts in March till June, and then that will run in my shows for the Edinburgh Festival. And so, you know...
What's the focus of the new show? Because again, The Fringe, it's always a show. It's a show.
Well, it's going to be stand up. I don't want to be a narrative where I at the end of the hour I cry.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know, I want it to be a story about what's happened to me in these last couple of years, but be able to stand up as well as a club set as well. So even though I'm doing like stories and I'm trying to do the narrative, is that from when the donkeys to when we have the BAFTAs, know, and all that happened in between. It's going to be a stand-up. It's going to be stand-up show. It's not going to be me sitting on a box going,
yeah,
like, and then, and then, and then, Enough, I wish my dad was alive.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
This then cry at the end. And then the lights come down.
It's a classic at the Fringe these days, isn't it?
Yeah. Cry. It's going to be stand-up. Yeah. So that hopefully I'm going to be able to... So I could take 20 minutes out of any of this bit of show and do it as a stand-up set.
Yeah,
But it will be telling the story, if you like. And that's my challenge. And I'm off to Ireland for 2 weeks to write with a friend of mine who we get on great and throw a few ideas about.
Great.
So, you know, I'm going to put the work in. It's, you know, I'm 60.
Yeah.
So I guess I've just got to keep this going till I'm, you know, 10 years, 70.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'll probably just sit in an armchair with a pipe.
Then,
you know what I mean?
And call it a day.
And then call it a day. Yeah.
It's going to be a busy 10 years, Dave.
It is.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to come and chat. And all the best with everything that's ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
That was David Johns, or Dave Johns, David, take your pick. It's not really that important. So thank you for tuning in. Next week, I've got an International Women's Day special with Holly. Holly Ross from the band The Lovely Eggs. And I'd wanted to have someone on for a while that is kind of in a job in gigging band and has been for a long time. And that isn't to say a mid-level band is what I mean. The kind of band where you might have to have a day job or you might have to have this or that to support things, rather than that high level where it's all tour buses and hotels, that level where you're potentially sleeping in the back of the van and things like that. And the dedication has to come in there. And Holly hit me up, because she was like, look, I'm a woman in a band, and I decided that I wanted to have a child and I didn't want to stop doing the band. So I wanted to come on the podcast and talk about that and talk about how life works and life changes when you're taking a baby on the road with you. And you're not at that level where you're a Beyonce in big tour buses and planes and nannies and all this kind of thing. So yeah, it's a fascinating one. So I think you're going to enjoy that. That's next week. I've also got Dan Hardy coming up. I'm going to chat to him ahead of UFC London, but it's not just a podcast for UFC fans. It's not just an episode for that. We're going to be talking about his new book and his whole life. Really, it's going to be a fascinating one. And then after that, I've got Susan Wacoma, maybe after or maybe before. I've not decided when these are going to drop. And she's in Chewing Gum and Crazy Head, and she's amazing. And it was a great conversation with a young black lady from South London who has just been smashing it in the acting industry in the last year or two in particular. So that's a great talk as well. So you're going to enjoy them. For now, I shall leave you. I shall bid you adieu. Yeah. That's the weirdest ending ever. Just, yeah. All right. I'm going to be in LA next week. That's all I've got to tell you about that. I'm not doing any gigs or any performances. I'm hopefully going to nail down some of my cool, hip LA friends to do podcasts. I'm hopefully going to jump on one or two podcasts while I'm out there. And I'm hopefully going to have a load of meetings with cool acting-type industry people to continue my amazing career. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be fun. But it's going to be work. So fear not. Anyone who's going to be going like, hey, we should hang out, probably not going to be doing any hanging out. I've not scheduled any days off. I could only squeeze out like 6 days over there. So I've not scheduled a single day of kind of chilling and relaxing. It's hustle. So, I'm going to be doing that. Obviously, I will have recorded the podcast. So you're sorted. I'm talking nonsense now. Go on your way. I'll catch you next week. Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.